pitch here for you to come to more lunches at the FCC. They have an announcement that the Tibet lunch, the International Campaign for Tibet, was postponed. Kate Saunders will not be speaking tomorrow, so if you had not heard that or read your email, it will be rescheduled, but right now it's not happening tomorrow. On March 17th, it's in the afternoon, though it's not a lunch, is a club seminar on accounting scandals and detecting financial irregularities. And the speaker is Thomas R. Robinson, Managing Director of the CFA Institute. So that should be interesting. It's a little late, but, you know, better late than never, I guess, to get these things straight. On March 23rd, on Monday, there's a club lunch with a presentation by Albert Ho, the chairman of the China Human Rights Lawyers Concern Group, and he's going to be talking about Charter 08, which is maybe the dawn of a civil rights movement in China. Cross your fingers for that one. On Tuesday, March 24th, there's a club lunch by Cameron Duke, who's a yachtsman assistant editor of the Financial Times, called Open Passage Expedition, Sailing the Northwest Passage Summer 2009. So it's an event yet to happen, and maybe you can sign up for it if you're a keen yachtsman. Then on April 6th, there's a club dinner with Sandaram Tagore, who has a gallery in New York and London and here. He's president and curator of the Tagore Galleries, and he's going to talk about the promise of modernism and Indian art from 1900 to the year 2000. Now, as most of you know, we are cooperating with the MAN Literary Hong Kong International Literary Festival, and we thank the sponsors very, very much from the bottom of our heart, MAN Investments, for undertaking this MAN Awards. It's fantastic. The Asian Literary Review, a publication that seems to be surviving so far, and please support it by buying one on your way out, in addition, of course, to our speaker's book, which is on sale. We also thank the South China Morning Post and, of course, Dimex for being just so fabulous and being here to support all the literary speakers and people who have come to town to raise our culture. Now, if I may turn to the speaker, Chu Xia Te, who is the author that's going to speak today, and she is going to talk about writing in a foreign tongue, the attractions of English. A Malaysian Chinese, probably born speaking Malay, she's trilingual. She studied English as well as Mandarin Chinese. So she writes in Chinese, and she's won prizes for her Chinese prose, and now she has turned to writing in English. And she, her first collection of prose was written in Chinese and published in 1998. It's called It's Snowing, an account of her observer as an outsider in Scotland. She went to school in Scotland and has subsequently in 2001 or two returned to Scotland to do her writing because she has a very large family and they distract her from writing in Malaysia. So I guess the cold weather keeps her indoors and keeps her working. Her first novel in English, Little Hut of Leaping Fishes, was longlisted for the inaugural MAN Asian Literary Prize and is one of those, well, for me as a Chinese scholar, captivating stories of a young Mandarin born into a family with his whole future written and having historical events overtake him and having to change his plans. Now, with very great pleasure, I introduce Ms. Chu.
Thank you, Bonnie. Good afternoon, and thank you so much for coming. I love this venue. Why? Foreign. That reminds me of my status in Scotland, well, in the UK, Scotland, Glasgow right now. An outsider, in a place that people don't speak my language, and I am a non-native English speaker there, or in Scotland, non-native English Scottish speaker. And correspond. When you correspond, that's communication. Communication, you use language. So it is a perfect place for me to talk about this topic, foreign language. And then when all foreigners get together, you need one common language. And English is that common language, because it's an international language. Well, so, you know, I already touched on a little bit about on this topic. Now I would like to use my own experience as an example about why of why a non-native speaker would write in English, and with that we can make generalization. Now you can realize that definitely I'm not a non-native English speaker. And why would I write in English? You know, I did learn English at school. I went to Chinese school in Malaysia. But English, we learned English in secondary school. That was only one of the many subjects there. We didn't really pick up much. Not even when I went into the university, the medium was Malay then. When I started working in the corporate world, you had to speak English, but that is our Malaysian style English. It's very different. Now, I have been writing in Chinese for a few years before anything, before I thought of writing in English. Over that few years, even though I had two books published, that was nothing in Malaysia. You know, in Malaysia, writing wasn't a career at all. You know why? You have to work full time, and then writing is just can only be a hobby. You write it during your spare time, but if you have a job that is demanding, like me, I have to work from 9 to 9 in a retail company. As an organization and methods executive. Now, when it comes to work, it's a responsibility. I had to carry out my responsibility, but because of that, I have to give out my love for writing. I was fortunate to get two books published, two collections of Chinese prose. But then, publishing me, and when you get a book published, the publisher gives you say 100 copies. That's your only reward. You have to go and sell your books yourself. But then your dear friends will come to me, come to you and say, "Oh, I heard you have a book published. Can I have one?" And you have to give them one. It's never ending, and I wasn't happy with the job as well, because I wasn't able to write as much as I could. Because of that, I made a drastic decision that I would give out my job and then write full time. But writing full-time in Malaysia, as I said, is impossible. The society was not ready for that at that time. So I decided to leave for the UK. I went to Scotland for the first time in the 90s to study a master's in media culture. And during that time, I had a chance to learn screenwriting. And then with that, I wrote the first piece of fictional writing. That was a film, short film script, which later made into a film and won an award in Vendome International Festival. But, you know, short film script is very different from literary writing. So I eventually, after that film script, I had to go back to Malaysia again. At the time, I had a chance to visit China for the first time in 1999. And that changed my life completely, that trip. When I was there in China, I realized that I was different from the Chinese people over there. Why? You know, in Malaysia, as a Malaysian, every day you see people from different backgrounds, the Chinese, Malay, and Indian, and we live together in harmony. We have this Malaysian culture, and I still practice my Chinese culture in our Malaysian way. And this kind of practices in some way are quite different from those cultural practices in the mainland China. So when I was there, I began to ask myself, why am I different, and why am I a Malaysian Chinese and not a mainland Chinese? What's the reason? And later, we went to the plateau of the Yellow River. When I was there, standing there, looking at the landscape in this yellow dust, that ancient feelings came back to me, and some feelings from the literature that I studied, Chinese literature. You know, I grew up in Chinese literature. Chinese literature has a very extensive description of the landscape. So in the rural China, this kind of landscape still persists. So when this ancient view come back to me, I began to have the urge of wanting to know more about the culture, the history, and the reasons behind the mass migration of the Chinese people to Southeast Asia, including my great grandparents. So when I come up with this idea, I thought, this is a message I want to deliver. And I want to reach a wider audience. I have to write it in English. No, I wasn't confident with my English then. When I went back to Malaysia, sometime in 2000, an English friend of mine who had a book published, and her first book shortlisted for the Booker, and she sent me the book. But if you want to know, her name is Rachel Seifert, and the book is The Dark Room. The book is written in very simple poetic prose and very different from those standard English writing novels that I have read. So I thought, oh, English can be written in a different way. And I started thinking, probably I can make use of my knowledge in Chinese literature and try to experiment it in English. So that gave me some confidence. And that was the time that I decided to leave Malaysia again to an English speaking environment to write that book, because I needed full concentration, and I needed that environment. So you can see the reason behind my wanting to write in English. The first is to reach a wider audience. And I also mentioned about the difficult situation that involved a financial reason. You know, I won't be able to survive as a writer in Malaysia. And the third is for artistic reason, because I want to experiment something different. Now, I mentioned about this poetic Chinese prose style. You know, classical Chinese literature that I learn are usually written in certain tone, pace, rhythm. And when I transfer it to English, it feels different. I'll just show you an example. This is the opening of this book. I just wonder how many of you have read this book? Right. It's good that you haven't read, so that you can feel the difference. Now, the first few paragraphs from the first chapter is the best example I can show you. Chai Mansion, 1875. Autumn in Plum Blossom Village is a season of sweat and laughter, of echoes and echoes of golden fields, of paddy reaping and threshing, naked stalls and plum-eared rice, smiling faces, exhausted bodies, barefooted children run wild in the open, chasing after dogs who chase them. Mothers prepare meals for fathers busy in the fields. Crickets high in the bushes, their noises crackle over the sky. Chrysanthemums smile a bright yellow. Snakes lurk in the mangroves, waiting patiently for toads and frogs that wait patiently for mosquitoes and flies. At night, as soon as the last streak of evening fade, chimneys stop smoking, doors are shut tight. Under the thatched roofs, contented children wander through dreamlands, smiles on their faces, saliva at the corners of their mouths. Mothers don shoes and shirts for fathers who enjoy a last puff of the pie before bed, before the day starts again. So it is tonight. So this is the introduction that bring the description of the place, Plum Blossom Village, the atmosphere of the people, the happiness, and then I intentionally write in short sentences so that to create certain kind of rhythm and pace. So this is one of the example that I mentioned as I refer to as translating Chinese literature in English. I didn't write this book in Chinese and translate it. No, I never did translation. When I was writing this book, my thinking was in English, not in Chinese. If I think in Chinese, my writing will be completely different. That will be like a translation. Now, that's why persons who are non-native English speakers, when they write and language that is not their mother tongue, usually the result is a kind of new English, a different English. That was the same kind of impact to me when I read Arundhati Roy's The God of Small Things. The way she uses the language is so flexible, and she didn't even bother to translate certain things. Like, you know, you can see phrases like or words like papachi, mamachi, amu, and all these things. I didn't feel awkward at all. You know, I just take it on. It feels fresh to me. This kind of feeling that language, writing, writers from a different culture, when you write in English, you bring in your culture into this language and create a new kind of language. Is also supported by Chinua Achebe, who writes in English, and a very successful author, who won a international Man Booker International Prize in 2007. And I noted here he says something like, yeah, Achebe felt that the English language will be able to carry the weight of my African experience, but it will have to be a new English, still in full communion with the ancestral home, but altered it to suit its new surroundings. So this is exactly how I feel and what I'm doing. I don't see this as pollution, because language evolves all the time. It changes because there's a need for changes. I know I'm from a multicultural society, multi-language society, so I observe it very clearly how these different cultures, people from different cultural background and different language backgrounds, when they move, when they meet and integrate, the language changes. I think most of you can understand Cantonese here. Yong Tau Fu, okay, that is a Chinese food. But we have Yong Tau Fu in Malay now. You know, and English has been using so many words and phrases from Latin. So why can't you accept words and phrases from Indian language, from Malaysian language, from Chinese language? This is a natural process, a kind of integration and assimilation, and to me, it enriches the language, and this is not something negative, but something positive. I think my time is up now.
Yes, I mean, and you may go on if you like, but we might like to give the audience a little time for question and answer. So Ms. Che will be selling her books. Ms. Chu will be selling her books and will be signing them later. But if you would like to come back here.
Yeah, I'll answer your question. I believe that from what I said earlier, you probably all have questions. Maybe you disagree with me. I welcome all your comments.
Well, we thank you very much for the speech. Thank you. And I think most of us here who have lived in a multicultural society, or at least a multilingual one, will appreciate these comments very deeply, because so many words do creep in. If you look at English itself, it's a very mongrel language, which takes words from all sorts of languages and then pretends they've always had them. So is there any question from the audience at the moment? Or from the table? Yes.
Can I ask the first question?
Probably
the most famous writer who wrote in English but had another cultural background was Joseph Conrad. To what degree, actually we talked about him before, specialist here of Joseph Conrad, to what degree did Joseph Conrad's experience shape you?
Joseph Conrad, he writes extensively about Africa. I wouldn't say his experience shaped me. He didn't write in French. He write in English. I don't see how French influenced much in his work, but I see it more clearly in Achebe's work, in Ben Okri's work, in Arundhati Roy's work. So I don't think his work shaped me.
Conrad has taught in all English literature and comparative literature courses all over the world, I suppose, but it's very Western, since he happened to be from Poland, I think. I have a question that's a little closer to China, because I have a degree in East Asian languages and literature, and I was enchanted with The Romance of the Three Kingdoms, The Dream of the Red Chamber, The Golden Lotus, if anyone's read that. There are many attempts later by English writers or English writing writers who try to mimic these romances and these novels of mystery and war and intrigue and the imperial forbidden city. I noticed that just from the cover, I have not had the pleasure of reading the book yet, but your book is very much about the formation of Chinese society over about 100 years, and it incorporates all those things that, to me as a young student, felt so exotic when I was in Indiana, but now seem rather familiar to me. So what prompted you to write such a large scope and bring in all the elements of traditional China to the modern day?
When I started writing, when I came up with this idea of writing this book, my intention was to find out the reasons behind the mass migration. That was my intention. I did not intentionally highlight the cultural elements in it, but because I'm writing about that period, and then I'm writing about my character's life. When you write about the character's life, when you write about this period, and this people's life is involved the culture, their culture. So naturally, these cultural elements come true to the writing, because especially the way I wrote this book, you know, I have a background in film, in film writing, and in this book, I experiment with the filmic style of writing as well. So if it is a filmic style of writing, I write the book, I write the story scene by scene. That means I have to give very visual descriptions of this character's, what he does in this scene. So when there's a description, I have to give, when I have to describe vividly of what the character do, and you know, the whole scene, I have to bring alive. I just give you an example. I'll read from this. This is a scene of my character's, my hero's grandfather. He organized a Peking Opera troupe to celebrate his 60th birthday. So this Peking Opera performance, this whole scene represents a few things. The wealth of this family, and also how this grandfather treats his grandson and his superstitions. I'll just read this bit. Okay. A loud gong marks the opening of the Peking Opera. The legend of Lady White Snake is unveiled. Little White, the snake demon played by Golden Swallow, fights against Master Cheng Hai, the monk who is determined to separate this snake demon from her human husband. Golden Swallow waves and flaps his long flowing sleeves and swirls round and round. But Master Cheng Hai seems stronger. Little White is pushed to the ground, to the floor, mourning. All eyes are on the stage. Mingzi quietly sneaks in, hiding himself among the crowd. Chako, his dog, following him closely. Master Cheng Hai steps forward. Little Green, the faithful maid of Little White, rushes to stop him from hurting her mistress. Mingzi strains his eyes. This green snake, Little Green, looks familiar. Her round eyes, sharp nose, and delicate lips. Little Sparrow, Mingzi is stunned to see his friend, almost unrecognizable in heavy makeup and the maid's costume. But Chako has spotted him. He barks joyfully, wakes his tail, jumps onto the stage, and runs to Little Sparrow. The musicians drop their large and small gongs, drums and crapple, yeching and hooching, erhu and sunshine, all four clinking and clattering. Golden Swallow strings into a corner. The monk actor brandishes the spear in his hand. Little Sparrow stands still, while Chaku passionately rubs his back against the petrified actor's legs. The crowd exchange queries, their voices droning in confusion. A black dog on stage, on my birthday, trembling with rage. Master Chai braces himself with his dragon stick. He watches Chaco happily jump down from the stage, threading his way through the crowd, running towards the back of the hall to Mingzi, the master's beloved grandson. Numb to his feet, Mingzi exchanges a quick glance with Little Sparrow on the stage. They look into each other's eyes, dull and lifeless. Now, I just stop here. I just want to show you, because the way I write, I bring out this Peking opera. Now, to a person who are not familiar with this kind of Chinese performance, they will think that I intentionally brought out elements of exoticism. But for me, there is a need to show it. So I didn't intentionally bring out all these cultural elements, but I bring it out because there's a need for it, to sum up.
Oh, thank you. That was wonderful. Gave me the chills. Any questions from the audience? Yes. There's a microphone coming around.
Would you say English was another language you wrote in, or do you see yourself as having moved into writing in English for now? Like, do you see yourself writing in Chinese again?
Right. For the moment, I have a plan. With this book, I actually plan for a trilogy. So I'm writing the second one, and there will be a third book. So definitely read these three books. I think will be the second and third will be in English. I probably will write in Chinese again, but I don't know. You know, I've just been thinking if I can establish myself with these three books, and if I write in Chinese, I can get people to translate it. If I just want to write stories and doesn't care much about experimenting anything new. But I haven't have any plan at the moment. But I won't say no.
Well, that's good news for the Chinese. yes.
Hi. I'm completely in awe of anyone who can shift language. Published work. I've recently finished a book by fiction by Alexander Heyman, who's a Bosnian writer who moved to Chicago during the war in Sarajevo and didn't have any English at all. And now he's written, he's a stunningly talented writer. I think the latest book is called The Lazarus Project. It's a kind of a globalization. He's writing about the effect of globalization on persons who have migrated into urban areas that are just phenomenally different from what they experienced. I don't know what it took him. His English is so creative, presumably because of that process of having to learn how to translate for himself. When you were first moving from writing in Chinese into English, can you describe a little bit about what the trials were in that kind of a? Presumably, you had a couple years where you were translating. You were writing in Chinese and translating it into English, or were you writing directly into English? And how did you mature your process of shifting from one to the other?
Right. I never translate any of my work from English to from Chinese to English, or vice versa. Because, you know, when I decided to write in English, I wanted it to be in English, and as I said before, once I get over that psychological barrier I mentioned earlier, I wasn't confident with my English. But when I realized that I could try other possibility, I could just, you know, try to ignore a little bit of the standard English grammar, the rules. I had the freedom of trying everything just the way I like. Some people approve it, some people don't. You know, I did a creative writing course at Glasgow University. I have a few tutors who read my book. Some of them try to correct my every sentences into the standard English formats. But I was fortunate that I had a tutor who just loved the way I wrote. And he just said, believe in yourself, stick to your gun. So that's what I did. I just feel fortunate, and I just try, I just experiment. So I didn't go through the process of okay, writing in full sentences and then cancel it. No, I didn't. Thank you.
Yes, two questions. Yes.
I just want to make a comment here. I mean, you just mentioned about the Bosnian writer. Well, I think any East European, you know, or South European, you know, writers in English, you know, it would not be so difficult for them to write in English because the culture is so close, you know, to the European culture. But for you, it is a double, you know, task. I noticed that you just said that writing in the film script, you know, influenced, you know, your way of writing scene by scene, okay? And I was just curious whether in your subconscious mind your knowledge of classical Chinese would have an influence in your English writing. It's not conscious, but maybe subconscious.
Yeah, you're right. You're right, actually. Because, When I was writing it, when I was writing it, yeah, as I said before, I wanted to experiment this poetic prose star, Chinese poetic prose star in this, and also the film language, my knowledge in film language. While I was writing it, certain paragraphs, certain sentences, I didn't try to craft it, intentionally craft it in certain way, but it just came out by itself. It just because I grew up in Chinese literature, and it just ingrained in me, the kind of prose style, it just ingrained in me. So when I was writing, it just came up by itself.
Oh, how lucky.
I think if you go to my website and the author's website I joined, the Red Room, I have samples of my writing that shows, you know, how it works. There are samples of writing that clearly show that the Chinese prose are very strongly in those writing.
Yes, and we had a question over here. Yes.
I want to know, when you write in Chinese and when you write in English, do you think differently? The reason I'm saying so, because I'm not a writer, but I do write press releases. When I give the same background information to an English writer and a Chinese writer, and I find that the press release is very different. So I was wondering, when you write in English, do you think differently compared to when you write Chinese? And also when you said that you write English because you're a native Malaysian Chinese, and then you tend to create new language. That new English language, does that mean that you're introducing new vocabulary into the English language, or you introduce a new style of writing English?
Okay. The first question, whether my writing in English or writing in Chinese are different. When I write in English, I sing in English. When I write in Chinese, I sing in Chinese. Of course, the two languages are different. The grammar is different. It is not possible that I write completely Chinese grammar, write in Chinese grammar in my English writing. That will become kind of direct translation, and it will look really, really awkward. I just wonder if I answered that question. You know, they are separate things. And then the second question is, all right, it's not just about vocabulary. It's a sentence structure. You know, like earlier on, the paragraphs I read, I have very short sentence, and I speak up the sentence. Some people think it awkward. I did introduce vocabulary as well, and also in this Peking Opera extract I read, I didn't translate the musical instrument like erfu, sanxian. I wrote down the pinyin instead of translating them. You know, just like Arantati's Lois, Amu, Papachi, or Mamachi, this kind of vocabulary. But the most important to me is the sentence structure. And also the cultural elements introduced in it.
Oh, wonderful question. I think Ernst has another follow-up question. Sorry, Ernst, I didn't mean to ignore you.
No, but you're moving from your mother tongue, writing mother tongue into English. Do you see this as a wider trend in the region, especially Southeast Asia? Because what we see in India, which is also an area with many different languages, people who, for practical reasons, as many of the reasons you gave why people move from their mother tongue, writing in English, that English actually in the region becomes, maybe outside of China, becomes the lingua franca of literature, or will the different smaller languages in Southeast Asia, like Malay, Indonesian, etc., still, or in the Philippines, Tagalog, still will survive as literature?
Definitely, they will still survive. Say in Malaysia, we still have Malay literature. We still have Chinese literature. There are still people writing in the Indian language. It's the Hindi. Is it Hindi? Hindu language. I believe they still survive because we have. Like in Malaysia, we still have Chinese school, we still have Indian school, and Malay is the national language. We can't ignore this. And especially for Malay language, it's a national language, and everybody has to learn it. And Malay literature is supported by the government, so in no way they will disappear. And the Chinese in Malaysia, because we have to try very hard to uphold our language. We have, because of the pressure from the government to close down Chinese school, so we have to work very hard to maintain our language. And because of this group of people working there, the language will never disappear.
That's fantastic. Another question? We have time for one last query here. Yes? Douglas.
Just a simple question. Who do you think you're writing for? You described the decision to choose to write in English as being principally motivated by a desire to reach more wider selection of readers. Do you have in your own mind an image of the reader you're writing for? Obviously, would it be someone like you?
Everybody. I want everyone to get the message I want to bring across, because it's very important. What happened in China during that time, 19th century, you know, after the Opium Wars, the foreigners went in China and tried to get a piece of it. When life becomes so difficult there, people left China, and you see Chinese people all over Southeast Asia, and that changed the whole culture and social, political landscape in Southeast Asia. That's why the multicultural society exists in the Philippines, Malaysia, where else, even Hong Kong, Singapore, Thailand, Indonesia. I mean, why people don't question that? Why people don't try to find out why? So this is very important, you know, and what happened China and Southeast Asia at the time, what the foreign powers did to this area. Why people doing that question? And just sometime last month, I spoke to a German friend, and he said, we German, even though we are so many generations away from the Nazi period, but everybody try to remind us our guilt. But why other people like the British, the French, the Americans, and many other who invaded Southeast Asia and Asian countries, and why they don't have that kind of guilt? Why just us? I know. Just a question.
That's a question for another time.
It's not about that question, you know. It's just another thing about why so many people writing in English at the moment. You know, 10 years ago, there were no, or I didn't know anything about these creative writing courses. And right now, there are so many creative writing courses everywhere. And also because travel becomes so easy, and people go, more and more people go overseas to studies, and they are exposed to this kind of the possibilities of learning to write and becoming a writer. So you see, say in Malaysia, you see Tash Au is a graduate of East Anglia. It's the author of Harmony Silk Factory, longlisted for the Booker. So he's a graduate of East Anglia University, and also Preeta Samarasan, who studied creative writing in the States. So with this opportunities and possibilities, you know, you see more and more people getting published in the West, not just write, but also getting published.
The dream of all book writers is to get published. Well, on behalf of the Man Literary Festival, presented by Man Investments and the FCC, I thank our speaker, Chiu Xia Te, very much for being with us today. And you don't get away without the traditional FCC gift.
Oh.
There you are. Oh, sorry, just my knees take a long way up. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you all for attending.
Thank you.
If you have further questions, Ms. Chen will be signing books and selling books, and you can ask her more things at a more private moment.
Thank you very much. Picture. This is the traditional FCC for the magazine kind of picture.